We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580, on FM 90.9 HD2, and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanksgiving, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. We've just come through some days built around excess, and there will be more to come as we count down the days and hours until Christmas. How did we get here, and what does this say about us? This afternoon, we're going to talk with a reporter for The Washington Post who looked at the season from the vantage point of a suburb in Texas. Our guest this afternoon is Hank Stuver. He is the author of Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. Stuver says, for those who opt in, Christmas is supposed to exist as a pure moment of bliss and togetherness. Because it looms so strong in memory and because the happiness it represents can be so achingly elusive, Christmas can bring us down like almost nothing else. And while standing in line outside a big box retailer on Black Friday, he made this observation. Real lives are being lived here. People are shopping, but they're also falling in love or kissing a child. In this carved-out consumerismo are places and moments of true bonding, places to be seen and to see others, to simply exist. Hank Stuver writes about pop culture for The Washington Post. In addition to Tinsel, he's the author of a collection of essays on American life titled Off-Ramp. Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And you'll find our guest online at his website, hankstuver.com, S-T-U-E-V-E-R. Hank Stuver, how are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. Christmas is coming like a freight train. And it's interesting because I spent the last three Christmases following families and their experience of Christmas, and now I'm having the experience of just talking about it every day. It's like this cultural steamroller that can't be stopped.
Yeah, and I know from looking at your website, we are now 23 days, 9 hours, 50 seconds, and at this second, 13 seconds until Christmas.
It's shopping days left.
Yeah, shopping
unless,
days
of
left.
Course, you can find things open on Christmas Day. You can still do your grocery shopping at a grocery store, your Christmas shopping at a grocery store, maybe. So, but yeah, you have about 23 days left, so everybody panic.
You've written a book here about what you call the biggies, big issues. The economy, our sense of home, our notions of God. What set you out on this quest?
For 20 years, I've been a reporter who has tried to focus mostly on everyday lives, the extraordinary things in the ordinary things. I have written about strip malls a lot. I've written about people's weddings. I've written about people's funerals. But it seems like Christmas, I mean, I know that Christmas is the biggest common cultural event we have in our culture. Whether you're Christian or not, nobody gets out of Christmas in one way or another. even the people who proudly do everything they can to avoid it are, in a way, reacting to Christmas. And it is a half-trillion-dollar event in our economy. Our economy is now more than two-thirds, about 70% of our economy is driven by shopping. And so much of popular culture intersects with Christmas, not just politics and religion, but television and advertising, and now the global economy sort of revolves around how much we spend at Christmas. And so I thought, well, all of that is way too big, especially when you throw in the millennia of traditions that have evolved to give us what we consider Christmas now. But I thought, why not move to one of those brand new suburb, exurban, places in the middle of the country where everything is a chain store and a chain restaurant and big houses and big churches, and try to tell the story of America through the prism of Christmas.
So you went to a new suburb north of Dallas called Frisco. What should we know about Frisco, Texas?
Frisco, Texas is on what used to be the Shawnee Trail. In the 19th century, millions of heads of cattle were driven north from Texas along the Shawnee Trail. It's a high, flat land. It was a farm town, and then in 1902, the San Francisco-St. Louis Railroad came through, and that's how Frisco got its name, from the railroad. And until 1990, fairly recently, it was 5,000 or 6,000 people. And presently, it's about 105,000 people. All of that growth has come in sort of the last two economic bubbles that we've been through, the high-tech bubble and the housing bubble. And Frisco is, if you've driven across the country, you've seen a Frisco, and you may even live in a Frisco. It is a, you know, lots and lots of new subdivisions, a few dozen brand-new public schools, and 7 million square feet of retail shopping, which includes a gigantic mall, several huge big box strip malls, an IKEA. You know, so everything there is big and new. And when I got there in 2006 and started asking people about Christmas, you know, it was before the economy fell apart. So everybody, you know, was buying houses with little or no money down, and could buy a lot more house than they could typically afford. You know, and so that's where I sort of worked forward from there. That's the world I arrived in, and by the time I left, of course, it had changed quite a bit.
Yeah. The first year was 2006, then you were there in 2007 and 2008.
Right.
And you're now on a book tour, and I know you've been back in the area.
Yeah.
What's going on there today?
You know, the Dallas-Fort Worth area is fairly secure. Comparing it to certainly the upper Midwest or the Northeast, or definitely comparing it to Miami or Phoenix or L.A. or any place really seriously hit by the housing bubble burst, Texas emerged relatively unscathed, although all of the people in my book, I follow three families through my book, and, you know, they've each had their sort of awakening about what we're living through now in the Great Recession. And then there's some definite icons of the strip mall are missing. Linens and Things is gone. Circuit City is gone. Bennigan's Restaurant is gone. You know, there are noticeable things, and there are certainly foreclosures in all of these neighborhoods. All of the people that I read about in the book knew someone or lived near someone who went through a foreclosure. So it's a changed world. It's a bit more sober, but it's still very consumer-driven, still a lot of focus on materialism and things, in a world that's also very Christian, very religious.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we're still standing, but we've had a few teeth knocked out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, 2008 was the first year since the groups, lobbying groups like the National Retail Federation, started recording, you know, the impact of Christmas sales. 2008, last year, was the first year that it went significantly down that anyone could remember. And, of course, the consumer confidence level was the lowest ever measured. This year, they're expecting it to go down again, although not as much as last year. So it's interesting that the people who run our world of malls are, you know, reducing their expectations. We've really let them down by not seeming to have a limitless supply of shopping money.
Mm.
Credit.
Yeah. Of all the Christmas accessories you came across, many displayed prominently the word believe.
Yes.
And one of the main characters in the story is a woman who decorates homes for the holiday. And one of the things she told you, Tammy Parnell, was this: fake is okay here.
Mm-hmm.
What did she mean?
Well, we were talking about Christmas trees. Tammy Parnell is a gated community, stay-at-home mom. She's very involved in her kids' school. They go to a private school. Her husband has a very good job in retail as a vice president for a clothing company. But 3 months a year, Tammy hires herself out as a decorator who will come to your house. Her business is called Two Elves with a Twist, and she will decorate your house for Christmas. And there, the level of competition is such that you don't have just one Christmas tree, you typically have five. And we were talking about Christmas trees, and I said, well, how many of your clients have real trees, real Christmas trees? And she said, oh, she just looked at, she had to back up. She thought, oh, he doesn't get it at all. No, everybody has artificial trees and artificial greenery on the stairwell and on the mantle. And I said, it was the conversation we were having. She said, fake is okay here. And I said, go on. And she sort of extrapolated it a little bit, you know, to, the female form at her country club swimming pool and jewelry and everything else that she could think of, that, you know, artificial was okay because to her the sentiment is very strong, the belief system is very strong, but the greenery may be fake. It indicated mm-hmm. that this was a world of artifice.
Yeah.
And she was at times aware of it, and she was at times part of it. And now having read the book, she has started to think more about the difference between those. How is she part of it? How is she feeding into it? And how is she keenly and smartly aware of it?
Yeah, we've got a listener who wants to join the conversation, so I want to get to them
pronto.
But I do want to say it is really something to think about, you know, this side-by-side existence of the direction believe in the midst of make-believe.
Yes. And, you know, all kinds of make-believe. Christmas make-believe, North Pole make-believe, housing prices make-believe, Ben Bernanke make-believe, retail shopping make-believe. Yeah, I mean, like, that's where I got sort of really tantalized by this project, was that, Iraq War make-believe. I mean, you could just keep going.
Let's take a call now from a listener waiting for us in Hoopston on line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste. Great show. Just a couple of observations for your guest to comment on. His description of Frisco sounds a lot like our Naperville, which is a community outside of Chicago. I can remember going to school there in the 70s, and, of course, it's nothing like it was. It's about 100,000 people now. But with regards to Christmas, I just feel that if, you know, so much is hanging on the consumerism, and because of what we've gone through, what I hear is that the consumer dollar, we're never going to spend like we used to. So there's a little foreboding there for the future, and I'm just wondering what he's thinking about that. And everyone seems to hang their hopes on a Christmas, you know, maybe circa in the 50s or 60s that just is not going to happen anymore. I mean, the breakdown of the family and so many other effects. So it seems like we're setting ourselves up for happiness, and it always seems to somehow elude us. And I just was wondering if you wanted to comment on some or any of that, and I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Out to all of that, I can only say bingo. That is, he's scintillated the essence of my book. To the first idea that he brought up, we are in real trouble, I think, in our country, because we are all waiting for an economic recovery that is still largely based on our ability to get back to the mall. Places like Frisco and the town that, outside of Chicago that he mentioned, once, you know, were simpler places. Frisco had a lot of pasture, a lot of cattle, a lot of cotton and other crops, and it had a railroad going through it that delivered all of these goods elsewhere. That model is broken down now, and, you know, we're modern society. It's a bedroom community. It's people who work in cubicle farms and spend their weekends shopping. So this is the economic recovery that we're waiting for that, yes, many economists are telling us is never coming back, that sort of easy money, always shopping society that we've grown quite comfortable with, in spite of knowing that it cannot stand. It cannot stand economically. It cannot stand environmentally. This goes with his second comment, which is we are always dreaming of a different kind of perfect, always grasping at a better-looking home, a simpler, more family-centric, peaceful existence that eludes us in our busy, sort of disconnected lives. And people really do fetishize the old Christmas, whether you're talking about Christmas 1950 or Christmas 1850, because we have a lot to choose from. We can go to Bedford Falls, or we can go to Charles Dickens, But we always have imagined that there was a better Christmas back then, back when Grandma and Grandpa had Christmas and they got one orange in their stocking and they got one toy. We all dream and idealize that so much that we collect like small little porcelain village houses for Christmas, you know, to sort of evoke that idea. Certainly all of our Hallmark specials are loaded with snowy evenings, village settings, old-fashioned, old-timey things that really elude us. I mean, nobody sells a porcelain set of a box store, you know, a Best Buy and a Target and all the people lined up around it, the tiny little porcelain people waiting to door bust. So we're just thrown all these images that don't line up with the lives we're living. And if we did have the kind of Christmas that Grandma and Grandpa used to have with one orange in your stocking and one toy, that would send our economy into a tailspin if everybody chose to have a simpler down-home Christmas.
Hmm.
I know that's a lot to throw back at your listener, but he started it because he seems to really get the ideas that I'm presenting here.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is reporter Hank Stuever. He's the author most recently of Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon at 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. It seems to me that you could take the subtitle of your book as hearkening back to Dickens' Christmas Present, but you could also look at it as Christmas, a Christmas present.
Yes, a gift.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that is the search that consumes most of us at this time of year, are the right presents. You know, the right thing to give one another. Gift giving is fraught. It's a field day for psychologists and economists to write about sort of how good and how bad we are at shopping for one another, how much angst we have wrapped up in it, no pun intended. You know, and what we've reduced it to in a lot of families now. I have a survey on my website, and people can get to my name is hard to spell, so you can get to the website at tinselbook.com.
Okay.
But you can take a survey there that sort of asks you, not only sort of anonymously, certainly, but it asks you sort of what do you spend, but also what sort of situations do you have in your adult family with, you know, like your siblings and your parents and grandparents, and then you throw in your children, and who do you give gifts to, and what do you give, and I ask a question about, you know, do you do gift cards? Because gift cards have really reduced it to this sort of exchange of currency. You know, gift giving is completely fraught. And so, yeah, the subtitle of the book is A Search for America's Christmas Present, searching for what does it mean to us now in the present. And also, there's definitely a lot of shopping. There are a lot of hilarious scenes in the book with, you know, people getting things for one another, taking things back. Certainly after Christmas is a melee of kind of like Black Friday of returning and disappointment and, you know, fixing and refuse. You know, I follow the garbage men at the end of the book.
Boy, after high school, I worked in retailing for a little while, a couple of years. And boy, it was nuts. It was just nuts.
I also worked a couple of Christmases in the shopping mall when I was a teenager. I have some good. I have one good memory about that, and I have several really tense, really exhausting memories about that. And this was back in the mid 1980s. You know, in a mall that now doesn't pass muster at all. You know, the malls have gotten so much bigger. But yeah, I mean,
what was your good memory?
Well, my good memory was it was a very desperate man who came into this. I was working in an American Greetings card store, gift and card store, and this man came in on Christmas Eve about 5 p.m., 6 p.m., just desperate to get presents for his kids, who he didn't think he was going to see, and then he was going to see. And he bought gigantic stuffed teddy bears and just whatever we had, I guess because the toy store was already closed. And then he needed it all wrapped, and I wrapped it for him. And he gave me a $100 bill, which in 1986 was something. It was something now, too. But it took me a couple of hours to wrap his presents and get him out of there. And, you know, you could tell he was dissatisfied with what he had gotten, but it was all he could get at that point, you know. But I'll always remember him. And he's one of the people I was thinking about when I was first starting to write this book, you know, sort of the joy that was in that moment, not only for me, but maybe for his kids. And, you know, the things we were wrapping up and the fact that I just, you know, went in the back room and did it. You know, we didn't typically wrap presents for people. But, you know, just getting it all done, getting him out the door, getting him on his way to his Christmas, but knowing that he had messed up somehow. He had put it off too long, or his relationship with his kids was such that he couldn't get it together, you know. But he was throwing money at the problem. I'll always remember it.
Yeah, I had a moment very much like that when I was working for a buyer in inventory control, and we would get pulled out of our cubicles to get out on the floor and help people in busy, busy times. And there was a dad who came in at the very last moment, and you know, he and his wife had separated, and just such a sad story. And here he was, desperate, and he didn't have much money, and oh boy.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that we have the same sort of memories? One thing that I have loved, I've been on book tour since a little bit before Thanksgiving, and I always have time. If people are willing to stand in line and wait, I always have time to listen to people's stories, and in each of them is something happy and something sad. My favorite music this time of year is that soundtrack to the Charlie Brown Christmas special, that Vince Guaraldi jazz soundtrack, because it so perfectly captures it. It's music that makes you feel good, and yet there is something so blue in there, so great, you know, what this season, Christmas has its roots as a winter solstice, as a festival, as a time when it was never colder and never darker. People gathered together and got very, very, very drunk. that's Christmas. And then, you know, in the 4th century, the church comes along and says, well, we're going to move the birth of Christ to this bacchanal in hopes of infusing some meaning onto it. And so for another 1,500 years, you get you go from there to Dickens. You know, you just keep improving on the myth.
Mm. And what do you think the Puritans would make of our Christmas?
Well, you know, one reason they moved here was to escape Christmas. And there's a very wonderful book, if you really want to get into this, there's a wonderful book that came out in 1996 by a professor in Boston, Stephen Nissenbaum, called The Battle for Christmas. Certainly the Puritans moved here to get away from the frantic street carnival that was Christmas that just repulsed them. And then, you know, it took America from, you know, the late 1600s, early 1700s, up until about 1830 to sort of work through this sort of the lawlessness of Christmas. I mean, it was really a time where, you know, your barn could be set on fire by hooligans until the Victorians sort of said, no, you know what? This is about fireplaces and families and locking the doors and shutting down the businesses and being together and, you know, enough of the wassailing. Like, we're going to have a home-centered Christmas. Mm. And there's going to be a magical elf who's going to come visit and give presents to people who get their act together and behave. You know? If you're good, you'll get something. If you're bad, you get nothing.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my question. So to me, it always seems that most Christmas gifts that you were talking about a little bit were, you know, in the modern home coming together are almost like a proxy for saying, I thought of you, I spent time getting this present for you, or, you know, I spent money that hence I couldn't spend on something else. And people seem to, you know, measure their value for each other a little bit by those gifts. And you thought about this, you know, psychologist having a field day. Do you have a sense of why it is so difficult for us to just, you know, for the most part, skip the proxy and give time and attention directly? Because, I mean, oftentimes it seems to me, you know, if instead of hunting for this present and spending this money, you would have spent the time with me, just talking to me, sitting down, having a cup of coffee, we both would have had more out of that.
Right. I think everybody knows this and believes that, but we are conditioned, literally from our birth, to build a Christmas around presents, around toys, around that expression of love, which symbolically, maybe your Sunday pastor would tell you, symbolically represents the greatest gift, for Christians, was God giving Jesus, or the wise men giving presents to the baby Messiah. But we are in a much more secular, much more frantic, much more complicated game here with one another, that really only a lot of self-assurance and therapy could say to a family, we're going to set aside the retail aspect of this. We're going to spend time with one another. That's a much harder gift to give. And in a lot of families, there's just too much history and baggage. In a lot of friendships and relationships, it really is easier to express our love through consumer goods. And it's not all bad. Before I spend too much of my hours sounding like I'm covered in green fur, these things are very good. Here's the thing about doing this book. I was so much smarter about Christmas before I actually got deeply involved in the lives of these three families for 3 years and saw that it is so complicated and it is so much about heart. I mean, there's an economist who has a book out right now called Scroogenomics, Joel Waldfogel, and he's made a very good, literate, smart, you can map it out on a chalkboard, an argument about how giving Christmas presents just economically does not work. It does not do what we hope it does, and it's economically a waste of time and effort and money. But he's forgetting about human heart, and he's forgetting about emotions, and he's forgetting about the up and down roller coaster that is Christmas, and he's forgetting that people are people. So that sort of is why I had to come back two more Christmases to these people and really watch them over time, and then sort of compare that to the history and culture of Christmas.
Listener, want to follow up?
That's fine. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for
the call. Next, we take another call from a listener in Champaign. Line 2, hi.
Hi, thanks. I think it's interesting what the last caller just said, because I think she's really right, but then in a way, what you just said is correct, too. I think that it seems like for some reason in the United States, we've come to the point where we've kind of live our lives vicariously through everything else, whether it's Hollywood stars or Wii games where you fake play tennis in your living room instead of actually really going out and playing tennis. And I think that the Christmas thing, in a way, is that as well, because people don't – we kind of want everything that's the easy way, whether it's fast food or a video game, rather than kind of trying – go out and put in the hard work that it takes to build friendships or to make a Christmas that's a little more real than all fake and artificial. And I think your book it sounds very, very interesting. And I'll just hang up. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Especially about watching sports on television instead of going outside and being active. Everything we know about Christmas, we learn from television. In fact, one of my fondest Christmas memories as a child, the year I was 14, we got cable television, and we had a very beautiful, real tree that we had driven to New Mexico. I grew up in Oklahoma, but we drove to New Mexico and cut down a beautiful pine tree at a Christmas tree lot where you can cut down your own tree. And we brought it back, and it was so big that we had to put it in our TV room, and we had just gotten cable. And I couldn't have conceived at 14 of a more perfect Christmas. And through that television came all this imagery of, what it's supposed to feel like. I think we default to what it's supposed to feel like, and we get sort of inundated with Hallmark specials and Every Kiss Begins with K and, big red bows on the Lexus in the driveway. And it's always perfect weather. It's snowing, but there's no traffic. There's no black slush. We really do internalize that, and intuit what Christmas is supposed to be like, mostly through commercials, but also through holiday specials, which we are fiercely devoted to. I have also, if you go to Tinsel Book, on my poll, you can take a survey about which Christmas special makes you feel most like Christmas. And right now, just by one percentage point, the Christmas that everybody really loves and admires and wants to emulate is A Christmas Story, which is the old Gene Shepard story that was made into a movie about Ralphie and his BB gun. You know, people now travel to Cleveland to see that house where that movie was filmed. That movie was filmed in 1983. It's supposed to be about a Christmas in the 40s. And here it is, 2009, and people want to go see that house. Now, do they want to see it because it's 80s or 40s? Neither. They want to see it because it makes them feel Christmas. And there's a leg lamp in the window, just like in the movie. And so they can. That's a pilgrimage. That starts to take on the idea of religion. And it's a piece of popular culture.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Hank Stuever is our guest today. He's the author, most recently, of Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. One of the people that you write about, that you focus on in the book, is a woman by the name of Carol Cavazos.
Yes.
What did you learn about Christmas from her?
Carol and I met literally in the Best Buy parking lot on Black Friday. I was out there in 2006. I had been living in Frisco at that point for 3 months and was still not entirely satisfied. I was following a number of families who had agreed to let me just hang out and be around with an open notebook at Christmas. And on Black Friday, I went out in the middle of the night to start talking to people who were camping out. And Carol and her family were camped out there waiting for Best Buy to open with very specific list of things they wanted to get on sale. Carol is the only person I met in Frisco who really stuck to a budget. Her budget for Christmas presents was $1,200, which is about average for Texas and about $300 more than the rest of the country. So Texas really does tend to overdo Christmas, which is one reason why I moved there to do that book. But Carol, for me, she was down to earth. She was also the only person I met in Frisco who had lived in her house long enough to pay it off in a very hard-won way. She's a single working mom. She's got, at the time, her youngest was 10 and her oldest was 25. She was about to become a grandmother. She'd been through two marriages, and she was fiercely devoted to her church and her pastor, and she went to this, still goes to this kind of rock and roll mega church that's very multimedia and very flashy. But in it, she found real warmth and spiritual satisfaction. And she was in a place that I could never reach myself. She's completely at ease with herself in a world of artifice and fakery, not only in the Best Buy parking lot, but at her church as well. She somehow had managed to become this very real person in an almost heartbreaking way. I just think the world of her. I think her church is kind of crazy, but, you know, like, I went there with her a few dozen times over 3 years and watched them do this gigantic mega church Christmas pageant that she was a part of. She's like in a world of fake is okay here, she was the realest thing I found.
What does she find in her faith?
Answers. Hmm. Answers in not always, you know, you or I or some of your listeners may think she's found the wrong answers, but she finds answers and, you know, answers to things like, is God looking out for me? Is there a God? You know, that's definitely answered for her. Can I put my faith in him that things will work out? Can I trust others? Am I doing the right thing? What is my guiding light here? In a world of disconnect, she had found that connection. She also made me see Black Friday very differently. You know, I was one of those people who every Friday, Black Friday after Thanksgiving, you can see it on TV, and you're like, who are these people? Why are they out there doing this? And after a few Black Fridays with Carol, I started to see it more like the running of the bulls in Spain. That's a cultural event, and it has the sheen of authenticity because it takes place in the old world, and it's European, and it's a festival. But it's no less crazy. And I think it's the same thing. Like, Carol sort of showed me that, yes, she wanted to get out there and save money and get her Christmas shopping done, but she also wanted to participate in something bigger than herself. In a crowd, in a town where, you know, people aren't in crowds very often. They aren't together rubbing up against one another. They are living in their little cookie-cutter houses, you know, going to work every day, going to the malls every day, but they're not really sharing something communal until Black Friday.
Yeah. It's interesting, as we're encouraged more and more to shop online, you wonder if this, if we could call it tradition,
will continue. Well, you know, as a newspaper man, I have a theory that the Internet ruins everything. And if it's going to ruin Christmas shopping without improving the values, you know, without improving sort of our perspective on how much we shop, if online is just going to allow us to spend ourselves into a deeper hole, then, you know, who needs it? But to me, you know, the Internet has messed with newspapers and the record industry and the movie industry and everything else.
And the radio industry.
We used to sit in a room together and enjoy a movie, complete strangers, but you still felt like you were in a room full of people. Now you're in your own room with your big screen downloading a movie, you know. It's another loss of community.
My husband and I went to a movie this weekend, and I loved it. It was wonderful to sit with other people.
With strangers.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's interesting about movies? This is off the subject, but, you know, the Lumiere brothers, who projected their first movie on a bedsheet on a wall in the 19th century, but Thomas Edison had this idea that, no, people would want to look inside a Nickelodeon and have their own private movie.
Mm.
And so for 150 years or so, or a little bit less, we had movies shown on a wall and that the dark room full of people would experience something together through the movie. And now we're sort of arriving at Edison's original idea where the movie is in the palm of your hand and it's yours and you're watching it alone.
One of those stories, this goes to, on the one hand, it's fun. On the other hand, it's thought-provoking. And this is a story you tell in the book about some Israelis who are working in the town's mall, Stonebriar Center. Tell us that story. Eitan and Tali.
Eitan, yeah, and his girlfriend and their their manager, Uzi. They, you know, if you walk through any American shopping mall, you'll encounter young people from Israel who are working at kiosks. Often they're selling soap, usually under some rubric like the Dead Sea, Secrets of the Dead Sea. They want to see your cuticles so they can help you improve the quality of your nails. But what happens is, apparently, after compulsory military service in Israel, which usually happens, I guess, when you're 19 or 20, a lot of these kids sign up online to go work in America, usually without a work permit, for 8 to 12 weeks at these kiosks where they're trained to be really aggressive with the shoppers and say, come here, I'm going to show you this miracle soap or this miracle nail polish. But Eitan in Stonebriar was selling powdered snow, where you just add water and you get flakes and flakes and flakes of cool synthetic snow, mostly so you can sprinkle on your porcelain Christmas Village collection or use it in some decorative way. And it was kind of a bummer for him because that was a hard thing to sell. By the time Christmas came around, he had a nice kiosk spot right near the Santa Claus in that mall, but you know, he was having to sell two or three boxes for the price of one. But he had a singular focus. He was working 12 hours, 6 days a week in the mall, and then after, I guess, 10 weeks, he and his girlfriend were going to go to California and to Brazil. And what they do is they earn a lot of money working in the malls at kiosks, and then they go travel.
What did he make of all this stuff?
He was bewildered, and he was bewildered by me. And a little nervous about me. I had to, actually, Eitan is a pseudonym. It's one of the very, very few places in my book where I had to change someone's name because, again, they're there working without proper paperwork. They're on tourist visas, but they're working in a shopping mall, which I think was the case there. I never actually confirmed that because their manager, a.k.a. Uzi, chased me off and shooed me away many times. But what I was gleaning from their story was that they were living in an apartment, four or five to an apartment, working at the mall every day and watching something they had never seen before, which was big old American Christmas. And Eitan was there on the red carpet day where Santa arrived on the fire truck and got down, and hundreds of people were there to photograph him and meet him. And he was just, he compared Santa to Paris Hilton. He was like, he's a celebrity. I'm like, oh, he's our biggest celebrity. But no, it was interesting. And I would check in with him every few days just to see what he was thinking about the increasing foot traffic in the mall, the relentless music being piped in. I really wanted to see more of Christmas through his eyes before Uzi chased me away. And they disappeared overnight. Like on December 24th, the snow powder cart was closed up, empty, and eventually became a Dippin' Dots.
They were on their way.
Yeah, they were on their way.
They
came, they saw, they left.
Yeah. And let's say one or two things about the other folks that you follow in the book. They are a couple who love to decorate the outside of their home.
Right. Well, we've all seen National Lampoon's Holiday Vacation with Chevy Chase's Clark Griswold, with the thousands of lights on the house, so you can, you know, see it. Satellites can see it from outer space. Jeff and Bridget Tchaikovsky in Frisco, Texas. If you go to FriscoChristmas.com, you can see a little bit of their house. They have 60,000 lights on their house. Jeff is, and you know, one of those engineer brains. You know, he was always interested and loved Christmas lights, but about 7 years ago, they started really putting on a show at their house, and it's become that house that every neighborhood has, or some neighborhoods have, you know, lots of houses like that, and traffic backs up for a mile or two to see the house, and the lights on the house are timed to dance to music, a Trans-Siberian Orchestra song, so that when you drive by, you can tune it in on your FM radio through a little shortwave transmitter that's in Jeff's house. So it's quite a show, and it takes quite a while of sitting in traffic to see the show, and Jeff does it because, for a lot of reasons, he collects food for the food bank by doing it. He has a box out front where people can leave food. He collects 2 tons of food for the local food bank. But he also does it because he knows he's living in a town that doesn't have a lot of traditions, a town that really sprang up and is made mostly of people who were moved there on corporate relocation. You know, they lived in a Frisco, Texas, just like Frisco, Texas, only it was outside Atlanta instead of Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows he's living in a town of transient, you know, suburban people who don't really connect to much besides their shopping culture. So he sort of glitzed out his own house, and now he also does downtown Frisco. And I say downtown Frisco, I mean a new village that has been built around a new city hall and sort of replaces the old downtown Frisco from 1902. You know, it's all very fascinating. But, yeah, what fascinates me most about Jeff and Bridget's Christmas lights in their Christmas house is not the outside of the house, but the inside of the house. A very interesting relationship, very interesting family with its own little Christmas dramas going on. So it was fun to be in their house, sort of absorbed in their trivial drama, their but also their emotional side of their lives, while outside this show is going on and the people in the cul-de-sac driving around to look at it have no idea, you know, who is this person? What are they like? What goes on inside the house?
You know? Yeah. As you mentioned, there are only just a couple of name changes here.
Yeah.
People allowed you to follow them around.
Right.
And tell them things about their lives and some very, you know, personal things about what they believe in and why.
Right.
And now the book's been out, and I'm wondering, how do the people who are at the center of the stories feel about it, and how does that community, Frisco and Plano, what kind of reaction has the book gotten?
I did some book readings and signings last week in, or 2 weeks ago actually, in Frisco and Plano and Fort Worth, areas around Dallas. And the reception at the readings has been really warm. There has been some upset in Frisco of people who don't like the book and think that it makes fun of the town and it makes the town look like this superficial world. The people in the book themselves, the three families that I followed, they all read it. They read an early release of the book in the summer, and they had very nuanced reactions. Nobody really hated the book, and nobody, I mean, I guess Jeff and Bridget, of all the three, they probably like the book the best. I think that Carol, who is, again, very centered on her faith and positive thinking, I think she thought that there were elements of the book that were too negative. And I think that Tammy was a little bit gobsmacked by her, the portrayal of her in the book, but I think that she also recognized herself. Nobody has said, "I hate you and I never want to speak to you again." There's something that they all wish wasn't in the book. They all have one thing that they wish I had not put in the book. But I don't think anybody was terribly surprised, because I spent so much time fact-checking not only the facts of the book, but also the feelings and the emotions. So it's been, it hasn't been rocky at all. We've all had really good conversations about it. Some of them have now met each other. You know, it's all been very interesting, and now we're all kind of in it together, because I'm getting a lot of feedback about the book, not all of it kind, and some of it great. You know, so it's interesting. It's like that post-journalistic experience now where, you know, I'm coming under some criticism, but I'm also getting a lot of really, really nice response to the book.
Yeah. You say early in the book, after years of sitting it out, you wanted back in, and I'm wondering now here, and I can give you about 30 seconds, once all the interviews are over, the readings are over, and it's a wrap, December 24th, how will you spend Christmas?
My partner and I are getting away. On Christmas morning, we're flying to the desert. We're going to be in Palm Springs for a couple of days. Irving Berlin wrote in I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas, where the orange and palm trees sway is where we're going to be, and then we'll be in Los Angeles, and we're kind of rebooting. It's Control-Alt-Delete Christmas, and then we'll figure it out next year.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you.
Hank Stuever has been our guest in this portion of the program. He is the author of Tinsel, A Search for America's Christmas Present. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Look for our guest and his book at the website tinselbook.com.